Hi, everyone, and welcome to Not About the Weather. I'm Brittany, and today I'm joined by Danya and Adriana as we run through our hypes and gripes and talk about everything and anything that is going on in the world. How are you guys doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for asking.
No problem. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, I'm mostly okay. I mean, I've been wasting my time over the last 2 days on a show that I'm just not going to name.
You said you weren't going to bring it.
I know, exactly. I'm not. But I've sunk so many hours into it that I just feel like I need them back at some point. Like, I want a refund on my time. Thank you for the show that I am not naming.
Go to your Zen place, Danya. Go to your Zen place.
Totally Zen until we get to my gripe.
Oh, boy. Well, anyway, we are Not About the Weather. This is a podcast where we talk about things that we're enjoying in pop culture or the world and things that are getting under our skin in the pop culture, general existence, you know, day-to-day stuff. So we come together with different hosts and groups and just air it all out, get everything on the table. And if you want us to talk about anything specific or suggest a theme or just get in touch with us about episode length, you know, let us know what you're feeling, you can contact us on Twitter at @NATWpodcast. We're on Instagram, Facebook, or Gmail. We have a website, notaboutthe.weatherpodcast.com. And we also have a Tumblr account, which you can follow us and send us asks, and we'll go through and try to answer anything that you have to pose to us. And also the natwpodcast.com also exists, and that's a hub for the Not Another Teen Wolf podcast. Is that what it is?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yes, that's cool. Right.
All of my friends are on it. It's totally fine. I just have no idea what it is. And it's the hub for this podcast and that podcast as well. So let's just dive right into it. And in order to determine whether we're going to start complaining or we're going to start praising, I'm going to flip a coin because every time I ask Siri to do it, she's just inadequate. So I have an actual quarter. And Adriana, do you want heads or tails to be gripes?
Tails should be gripes.
Okay. So I'm going to flip this coin. Hopefully it lands on my desk. It did. And we're going to complain first.
Yay!
Our favorite thing in the world.
Very appropriate.
I'd actually like to go straight with Danya because I have been on the outside of this conversation a lot, reading back and forth between what she's not into with Riverdale. So kick it off, Danya.
Yeah, so I guess it came up in a previous episode based on a comment I think we got from when I listened back to one of the episodes I wasn't on, talking about Riverdale and the situation with Jughead. Now, for anyone who isn't familiar, Jughead Jones is a character from the Archie comics that is, he identifies as aromantic and asexual, which on the queer spectrum is like an intersection that happens. Sometimes it is a different version of asexuality, and so it's not one that's very commonly portrayed. It was only very recently in the Archie comics that they even gave it a word. But Jughead, throughout the entire history of the comics, has always been on the fringes. He's never been interested in sexual relationships or romantic relationships. For the most part, and it's the joke that everyone makes, he's more interested in burgers than anything else. But he's Archie's best friend. And one thing that happened when they were kind of switching from the comics and adapting it for television is that the aromantic asexual community got quite excited that this could be a real opportunity to have their identity on the queer spectrum portrayed in a character that a lot of them feel really attached to, because he is a hugely positive piece of representation in the comics. He is such a good character. Yes, okay, to some extent, he is still a flawed character, but he's not like a lot of queer characters are, one note. He's not kind of this odd sort of just shoehorned in because they need queer representation character. But when it eventually came to seeing Riverdale, it was discovered that he is not aromantic asexual at all. In fact, chances are he's not even asexual. And there has been a lot of discussion and a lot of back and forth on this. And there are a lot of excuses as to why. But basically the crux of it has come down to now Cole Sprouse, who plays Jughead on Riverdale, has come out in an interview and now stated that the aromantic asexual version of Jughead is something that exists in the comics, and this is a completely different Jughead, and we just need to get used to it. But that's not okay. Like, that is taking something from the comics and repackaging it because it doesn't fit this neat little teen sexual drama that they want. So he is now... I haven't watched the episode or any of the episodes since Jughead and Betty kissed because I got myself so worked up that I just can't bring myself to watch what the fallout from that has been yet. So I don't know if they are embarking on a relationship from Cole Sprouse's comments. I would hazard a guess that that is the case because he was talking very much that they are going to be involved. But the biggest thing that gets me about this whole thing is the response that people have had, particularly to aromantic asexuals in the community, because they are very often an ignored and illegitimized part of the queer community. Because, and I don't know why, the only thing I can think of is because they don't have something tangibly understandable to them that makes the rest of the community comfortable. Like, they don't feel romantic attachments, they don't feel sexual urges, but yes, within the spectrum of the asexual community, there are those that can and do have romantic relationships, and yes, there are some that even choose to have sex, but that's not relevant here, because it's not Jughead's experience, and it never has been. And you can try and excuse it and pass it off as like a questioning phase in his queer identity as he kind of attempts to figure himself out. But again, why does having a romantic inclination need to be synonymous with questioning? Because it's not. You can feel no desire for romance and sex and not want the same relationships as your peers do and still question why that is. You know, questioning isn't a one-size-fits-all. You don't need to kiss or sleep with or engage in a non-platonic relationship with someone to figure that out. Yes, that might be your experience as part of the queer community, but that's uniquely you. You know, it's the same argument that you can't know you're gay until you've been with someone of the opposite sex. So why? Why do heteronormative relationships need to be the touchstone for every lived experience? We never hear, how do you know you're straight? So why does that argument hold water every other way? And I'm tired. I'm tired of hearing the excuses being given over and over and over and over again, because this community is hurting and being attacked from every corner, where there should be solidarity and a willingness to listen to arrow aces. Instead, the media, the queer community, and even people involved in the show are just performing some incredible feats of mental gymnastics to invalidate their concerns. Because there was a Vice article that asked asexuals whether Betty and Jughead's relationship was hurting them. And while likely that did come from a particularly well-intentioned place, it was flawed from the outset, because being aromantic and asexual is a completely different experience to all other asexual identifications. So ask them, listen to them, support them, because this conversation has suddenly become so much bigger than Riverdale and Betty and Jughead. It is now, why are we so willing to pretend they don't exist? Whew, okay, I think I'm done.
Okay, so on the other side, I still have hope for Riverdale. and that's mostly due to Cole Sprouse, which I know you're very angry about that interview. Was that a written interview or a video interview? Because I saw a video interview.
I saw the transcription because I was at work when I...
I think you should watch the video because to me it makes it very clear. Like, Cole Sprouse has been very adamant since the beginning. Like, I went to the Comic-Con panel and he was very like... This was before the show even aired. He was like, yeah, no, I really think it's important that Jughead be asexual. Because I feel like Cole Sprouse is pretty, like, quote-unquote, woke in terms of, like, as far as white boys go. And he has been very adamant in championing that Jughead be asexual. And I think finally they were like, look, you have to stop this because that's not, like... It's causing problems because he's going out because everyone is mad and they're like, why isn't Jughead asexual? And he's like, yeah, no, guys, I'm mad too. And so I think that in the interview, it's very clear that he is like unhappy to be saying these things from watching him.
Yeah, I haven't seen the video one. I only saw the transcription. So that does take a lot of nuance out of like how people say things. But at the same time, that... I can be less annoyed at Cole Sprouse in that instance, but at the same time, if that is the PR for the show trying to manipulate the narrative here, that is still equally as problematic because they're trying to then stop that conversation from happening. Why?
Yes, but I also have hope because I think enough people are angry that there is room for them to change their narrative, because the way that you said the last thing you saw was the kiss between them, the way that they've been playing it, I feel since then, is very not romantic at all. It's almost like his relationship with Betty is almost like it's very motherly. Like, I don't think they've kissed again. I'm pretty sure they haven't kissed again. I'm trying to run through my brain. They've like held hands maybe, but that was like after something terrible happened with Jughead's dad and she was just like like comforting him. It's very like a motherly relationship.
But that's one of my concerns, is that like, then why the kiss? Why was it needed?
The kiss feels very out of place because I do think they have excellent chemistry. Like, before this, I was like, they have great chemistry, like as a crime-fighting duo. The kiss was so weird and out of place. But then after the kiss, like, they had good chemistry again. Like, when they're just being platonic, they have really great chemistry.
Yeah, that's it, though, because, like, Betty and Jughead's relationship was something that I was really enjoying, but not from, like, a standpoint of, oh, I feel like I want them to get together. I just thought, oh, they've got a really great friendship and dynamic that I think is just great. I think they work really well together. But that, for me, didn't necessarily preclude like this whole idea of, oh, well, that means I want them to get together, because it doesn't. Like, just because there is that great chemistry between them, why does that immediately mean that this show feels the need that they should enter into some kind of either romantic or sexual relationship with each other? That's the bit I just can't understand, why.
Well, one I think that's thing leads to the other. The creators and the executive producers are old people, and I feel like they don't understand the aromantic asexual experience at all.
No, they absolutely do not. But then they've got the comics right there. They've got the Jughead run that Chip Zdarsky wrote that is basically the 101 class. like, it tells them what they need to know. So if they had bothered to sit down and read it, you know, the actual source material that they're adapting from, then they might have gotten a clue.
I read an article by... She was asexual. She admitted she wasn't aromantic, so it's a different experience.
Yeah, I know that.
It's like do you know the one I'm talking about?
I know the one you mean. She is panromantic asexual, I think she said.
Maybe it's the same one. Yeah, but she said for her personal experience and that, like, she needed to, or she didn't need to, but when she was in high school, like, she did have relationships because she felt like that's what she was supposed to do, even though she, like, which didn't want to, like, she felt like it was something she was supposed to do, so she doesn't feel, so that she didn't feel, like, broken and different from everybody else. And I don't think this was their intention with Jughead, but I think that if they listen to everybody, they could make it this way, because since they have such terrible romantic chemistry, you could say that Jughead right now, because he is, you haven't seen the other episodes, he's going through such shitty stuff, like, he got framed for bad things, and his dad is so shitty, that you could say, like, everyone is looking at him like he's the weirdo. He needs to do something normal, and Betty is very safe. She's the by far the safest choice. Like, they're not even kissing. They're, like, holding hands. You could say he is choosing a safe choice right now to get the attention off him from all the other bad stuff. I feel like they could go in that direction if they choose to. I'm worried they're not going to, but I'm trying to hold on to the hope that they will.
Yeah, I'm genuinely concerned that that's not. And I want to believe that that is the direction that they will eventually go in, that they will get it through their heads and figure out that this is, well, I mean, it's who he was in the comics. That is basically, that is him. It's great that, you know, people are talking about their experience, particularly when they were questioning their sexual identity or their queer identity when they were growing up. But again, all the voices that are being showcased are ones that don't have the same experience. They are not asking aromantic asexuals about this. In fact, the Vice article didn't ask a single aromantic asexual about their experience or how they feel about Betty and Jughead. So every single voice that is chiming up about this, I mean, mine too, like, I'm not aromantic asexual, that's not my identity, but, and again, I'm talking about it, so, like, but I don't understand why we're not talking to them and why we're not showcasing their voices, because they are the specific people that are being affected by this. It is their community, it is their identity, and one size fits all questioning isn't a thing. Mm-hmm. And Jughead's, I guess, questioning throughout the Archie comics never included being involved in a relationship or, like, kissing or anything like that. So to see it then become something else, that's where there's this disconnect. But the biggest thing that I'm just getting so annoyed about is that nobody is listening to the aromantic asexuals at all. Like, those are the people that aren't being listened to, and they're the people specifically affected by it. So why are they just pretending they don't exist? Because they're not going to go away, and they're not going to shut up about it. So swallow this goddamn misplaced sense of pride and listen to them, because what they have to say is important. That's what I want at this point, is for them to just acknowledge them and listen to them, and in some instances give them the platform to be able to talk about this, because unless you catch their Twitter threads or unless you are specifically looking for aromantic asexual writers on their personal blogs, a lot of the time is what is happening, because they don't have a bigger platform to write about it. People just aren't seeing what they have to say, and that's,
I think,
the problem.
We have a good, I mean, you're making an excellent point. I think we have a good opportunity here. We should do that. Like, we can, and we can on Hypeable on here.
Yeah, you know,
we
what,
reach out.
Yeah, actually, if someone is listening to this and you identify as aromantic and asexual, contact me. Find me, Donya@hypable.com and @virtual_Don on Twitter. Find me. Come talk to me. And I will put your voice out there on a platform. Do it. Come to me, because I am sick of people not listening to you. Done. There we go.
I have not seen Riverdale. All I know about Riverdale is summed up in two words, which is hot Archie. Apparently he's uncomfortably
attractive. Archie is so hot.
That's literally all I know about it. I think there's even a hot Archie podcast.
He's even, you know, he's Polynesian, which is pretty cool.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I've only seen, like, pictures of him, KJ Apa?
Yeah, his dad is, like, a chief or something.
That's so interesting.
I think I read that somewhere.
Yeah, this is the thing.
Like Moana.
They have so much diversity in Riverdale in, like, the people that they've cast and, like, the identities that they are attempting to showcase. But, like, this is the one glaring, like, point where it's, like, just, It just gets my back up so much. So much. Though, yeah. Yeah.
Now that we've completely ruined your Zen place.
I know. I'm fine. Oh, wait until I get onto, like, literally any of my other gripes, because they are just as bad in future episodes. Just wait, guys. I've literally got a backlog of them.
I know. I feel like
they're all lining up to go.
I'm like, my list for, like, you know, prepping for this podcast is usually like, okay, which gripe? I'm going to spend like an hour deciding which gripe I want. And then I'm like, am I excited about anything?
Yeah, specifically, this one specifically was one that I wanted to do on this episode because it was so recently talked about on a previous episode. So, yeah, I figured that was why I should do that one on this episode and not another future one. But whoa, oh boy, I've got so many to go.
Well, that's why I chose my gripe specifically for this episode too, because you can't talk about the Beauty and the Beast press tour too far away from Beauty and the Beast, and it just came out yesterday as of recording this episode. So, whew.
I really want to know what this is, because
Really confused.
So let me explain. So I wrote in our notes doc that my gripe is the Beauty and the Beast pole dance, and Tom and Lorenzo, who are my all-time favorite writers on the internet, have, like, coined this term, and they use it to describe their posts on fashion about when people are out doing red carpets and press tours and interviews and stuff. They call it the pole dance for their, what they're promoting. So I now really in my head and aloud, I've caught myself referring to press tours as like, oh, they're pole dance because they're like, look at this movie that I did. It's so pretty, you know? So they're putting on the show. And the Beauty and the Beast one, first of all, I was on the fence about Beauty and the Beast since it was announced, since we got images and everything. I saw it very underwhelmed, almost left during Be Our Guest. That's a gripe for another time. I want to specifically talk about it was not my favorite
I have a very specific gripe about Be Our Guest as well.
Oh, it was
like very oddly specific.
during it, the only thing I was like, okay, they can save this if they still do the champagne bottles popping. Guess what, guys?
They did not. Oh, no. Instead, they had this really weird Holly-esque sequence with the colored powders.
And, like, did you see Cogsworth's, like, that was so weird. It was just,
this is my very specific gripe about Be Our Guest. It's not really a spoiler because it's very weird. And I said it on Twitter last night that I was very confused because at a random point in Be Our Guest, it broke into this kind of Indian-esque music. Like, it was like a musical cue that had it in. And I said on my Twitter that, like, what was up with the weird, vaguely Middle Eastern part in Be Our Guest? And then Cogsworth, like, pops out in a turban with, like, this Holly-esque sequence of colored powders just exploding everywhere. I get that that's supposed to be in the place of fireworks because that's not possible in this new universe-y type thing that they've set up, but that wasn't necessary. Like, that felt so out of place. And I know that, like, Middle Eastern isn't a thing. It is a very Americanized idea of, like, different subsets of culture. It was really weird because it wasn't anything specific. It was like this generic Americanized amalgamation of, like, what I guess they think different cultures are, which is what the term Middle Eastern is. It's just this weird, non-specific, generic amalgamation of, like, different cultures. It's not actually a thing. It's not real. It's just a way to, like, do this overarching thing. But that thing, that's my very specific, like, what the fuck. Yeah,
and it wasn't, like, a huge, like, break. Like you said, it was, like, a musical cue, and then it was still in Be Our Guest, but it wasn't, like, they suddenly broke off and did something else. It was just very, like, the whole number was not fantastic, and I was very nervous. Like, you know, they're walking Belle to the dining room, and I'm like, oh god, oh god, oh god, oh god. Like, because I was already so disappointed that I was like, oh no, here it comes.
It wasn't the first time that they did, like, a random musical breakout into, like, a different culture either. They did one in Gaston as well.
Oh, Gaston was so weird. I'm like, where are we, Ireland now? They're, like, doing the jig, and I'm like, I don't know what's happening.
Anyway, it was so weird. So weird. Right, back to the pole dancing.
isn't about Beauty and the Beast, but it went there a little bit. So today, as of recording this podcast, I am finally going to see Trainspotting 2, and I'm very excited. So Ewan McGregor has been doing press for both Trainspotting and Beauty and the Beast because they both came out in the U.S. the same day. So
that is the oddest combination of press tours,
right? So, like, an ex-heroin junkie and also Lumiere, like, let's, which one do you want to talk about? But Stephen Colbert had Ewan McGregor on the other night, and he too was, like, trying to point out, like, you know, well, how do you prepare for, like, you know, did you do heroin? And he's like, well, was I a candlestick? Like, you know, like, you know, it's not you don't, like, do heroin to prepare to be a heroin junkie, you know. But anyway, he was saying this is what, like, got under my skin. I was watching mainly for the T2 talk, and then they were talking about Beauty and the Beast, and he was saying how he was having a hard time doing the French accent for Lumiere, and, like, that they told him it was coming off like he was sounding, like, Hispanic or, like, Irish at some points, and he's Scottish, so it was just a mess. And so he said, though, he was like, and Colbert was like, oh, well, you know, did you go back and watch the animated film to sort of, like, imitate it? And he goes, I've never seen it.
What?
Yeah, he's never seen Beauty and the Beast. And I'm like, but you are playing Lumiere.
How do you not just, like, pop it in once for,
it's like 90 minutes
preparation?
And I was so angry with that one, like, and Colbert was like, how? And he goes, you have kids? And he goes, yeah, I have daughters ages 6 to 20. And he goes, how did this not play in your house on repeat? Like, how did you... And then it got me thinking, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, this is so true. My niece and nephew, they don't watch the old Disney movies. They never did. Their parents didn't give, like, put them on for them. And so this is going to be their first Beauty and the Beast. And because they're at an age where, like, they're not going to sit down and watch the cartoon, their, like, attention span is just not there anymore, like, to watch something old because they're so ingrained in, like, the new and CGI, that's what they like. So first of all, that's a gripe for a whole other time. I was so angry.
When did it come out? Was it 93?
Yes, it was. Yeah, because it was
92.
Yeah, it was 92 after,
because I watched it and I didn't watch it in theaters. Oh, yeah, I was either. Too young.
Yeah, I was too.
I watched it
on VHS.
Yeah, of course. My VHS, I don't even think my VHS would work if I put it in because we watched it so many times.
Yeah, my first, that happened to me as well. I watched it so many times.
Yeah, but yeah. I've been watching, so, like, this interview triggered me to go, of course, and watch a bunch of interviews, like, from the press tour and stuff, because, you know, you read headlines, like, only if something is said that's so ridiculous and, like, you know, whatever, and this wouldn't have made a headline, but it made me think, like, has anyone, like, what is the care and attention and connection of this cast to this movie? And none. I just didn't, yeah, no, I swear, I just didn't feel it. I was just like, why is anyone in this film involved in this film? I didn't feel anything from anyone when they're talking about it.
Yeah, and here's the thing as well, is that the person who's probably the closest to it in terms of, like, lived experiences of the original animated version is probably Emma Watson. And yeah. even then, I still feel so numb to her in yes. the film, because it didn't come across at all that there was that care. She just was so one note through the entire thing. And it threw me off because it's like...
To be fair, she's always one note in her acting.
I know. But... I feel that. Like, and before someone comes at me with a pitchfork, I actually really like Emma Watson when...
I do, as a person.
As a person. I think she's great. This is the same problem that I have in certain respects with J.K. Rowling, which I brought up on the J.K. Rowling episode. In respect to their public life and their advocacy, I'm super, 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 super into. But then the material that they're doing, I'm not so enthused with in certain respects. Emma is like that same sort of experience for me, in that I love her and her advocacy is great. And yes, she missteps. She missteps fairly often in the way that we as white feminists are prone to do.
That is my problem with her. I feel like she is very white feminist.
Yeah.
Like, I really love her. I think she's well-intentioned, but I do think she comes off as very white feminist.
Yeah. So, yeah, just in the film itself, like, that connection that she has to the source material didn't come across in her acting. And I don't know if that's just because that's her acting or, like, because no one else had it. So therefore, by association, it was just all dragged down to this singular one-note kind of blah
thing. And it's also, and it's not just her, I will say. It was a bunch of characters. I didn't...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, not to harp on Emma. It was just... It was across the board.
Yeah, on the whole, the film wasn't terrible. Like, it wasn't an awful film, mostly because that story's already ingrained in us. It already exists. It's already a tried and true story that we know people like. So from, like, start to finish, there was nothing inherently terrible about it. It just came across very, okay, that was the way that I spent... It was almost 2 hours.
Yeah,
I think
it was too long.
It's really weird. Yeah, it had some pacing issues and it felt a little bit like 2 hours, but it wasn't a completely terrible way to spend 2 hours the way I have been spending hours. It wasn't the worst way I had spent 2 hours.
Stop going back to it.
let me just say that.
Yeah, I, on the other hand, probably hated it a little bit more. I thought it was a waste of my time, and I'm kind of disappointed that I did see it. However, there's a silver lining of all of this that I almost am hesitant to bring up because it is kind of a hype about the pole dance. And that is James Corden did Crosswalk the Musical, Beauty and the Beast.
Oh my God.
With Evans, Dan Stevens, and Josh Gad. And I've watched it probably 5 times, which is almost half the length of the Beauty and the Beast feature film at this point.
loved it.
And it is so perfect. It's like, because they're making fun of, like, their roles and they're trying to take it seriously. And Dan Stevens is brilliant in the whole thing because he's just so, like, what is happening? Why are we performing in a crosswalk? Honestly, the production value of Beauty and the Beast, like, that song when they perform it, is almost as high as it was in the film. Like, they have, like, this, like, yellow sheet that they run out with on the crosswalk, and they're, like, holding it and making it shimmer, and James Corden is dressed as Belle in the full gown. Dan Stevens is the Beast. There's a guy behind the yellow curtain with a pole with a chandelier on it going over them.
It was so good. It was incredible. That whole thing was so good. And hilariously, there was more character from the three actors from the film, Josh Gad, Dan Stevens, and Luke Evans, in that little crosswalk musical.
Gaston felt so much better, and like Be Our Guest was, James Corden had more emotion on his face when he was being twirled in the chair in the middle of a crosswalk in Los Angeles than I felt Emma gave at all during Be Our Guest. He was so like in awe of these like people dressed as spoons dancing.
Yeah. I said to someone earlier, because they were asking how I felt about it, because I've talked at length on multiple podcasts and on multiple occasions and with multiple people, and like, and anyone who has like ever known me knows that like I have a lot of really strong feelings about Beauty and the Beast because I have such a strong connection to it from my childhood. And so a lot of people have asked me or come up and asked me in like private conversations, like, oh, what did you think? And I said to someone earlier that it feels like it's a carbon copy without any of the heart. Like it felt really flat, like it was just they were reading off a piece of paper in a really terrible amateur production. And that's not a knock on amateur productions, because amateur productions can be incredible, sometimes even better than the professional productions. So it just felt like a really, 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 really bad amateur production with a huge budget.
Yeah. Ariana, are you going to go see it?
No, just watching the trailer makes me angry. I can't. Well, Emma is not my Belle, and so I can't.
Watching Crosswalk Musical. It's the best 10 minutes of your life.
It is. It's so good. Hysterically, to me, the person that I would have chosen to play Belle is already in the cast, just playing a different role.
I told Ariana, I was like, I can't unsee it.
I know. Which is for anyone else who's interested in having their lives ruined by this mental image, because apparently that's what I like doing, ruining your lives. Gugu Mbatha-Raw would have been an incredible Belle.
Oh, yeah.
She has those giant Disney eyes.
She does.
Yeah. So you're welcome.
I just feel like Emma, and obviously it's different for everyone. Belle meant a lot to me as a character growing up. I feel like Emma didn't get why.
And it really just didn't give me any hope for the rest of the live action plans that they have. I'm almost like, okay, shut it down. Shut down the live action department. You did it. All right. So the way that I've come to realize most people feel about Beauty and the Beast is the way I feel about The Little Mermaid.
To go talk to Danielle.
I want to shut it down. I want to burn whatever scripts they have going. I want to like crash every casting call and just say, please don't make it.
Yeah. You definitely need to talk to Danielle about that, because she also has a lot of very strong feelings about Disney doing a live action version of The Little Mermaid. So I feel like you two should hook up and discuss that. The one I'm most concerned about is Mulan.
Mulan. Be bad too. But
I keep forgetting that they're doing Aladdin.
I know.
Mulan is like such a perfect animated film. It's so good.
Yeah. Though this will be like a tiny recommendation. There is a live action Mulan film already out there. It's a Chinese production. So it's called Mulan, Rise of a Warrior. So good. If you do want to watch a live action Mulan film, there is one already out there, and it's really great. I think it was also marketed as Mulan Legendary Warrior. So there are two titles for it, but it is a Chinese production that came out in 2009. So if you see it and you see 2009 next to it and it's and it's in Chinese, then you know you found the right one. So I highly recommend that if you're looking for a live action version of something that we're already sort of vaguely familiar with from Disney.
Boy. Now I'm just disappointed and sad all over again about the future of...
We should do a Disney princess episode where we hype and hype our princesses.
Yes. Oh, I'm into that.
I love that.
I'm into that. But first, we could talk about some more princes from a very different show, which, you know, some of us feel are... I don't know what side most people fall on. I have very strong feelings about this duo. So let's hear what you have to say first, Adiana, from the Jane the Virgin Prince perspective.
Well, there is definitely only one correct side to be on, and I'm about to explain why. So I don't want to spoil anybody.
Let's do a spoiler alert, because there's no way that we can discuss this without discussing what's happened this season on Jane the Virgin. There is just no way.
I think we can. I'm just going to say one sentence about it. Maybe you can't.
I maybe can't, because a lot of what's happening this season also plays into this discussion, I feel like. So just... high-level spoiler alert, just in case we can or can't do it. Jane the Virgin spoilers for this season. So if you're not up to date, then blaring alarm. That's our spoiler alert.
So also, in full disclosure, I stopped watching Jane halfway through season two because I was so angry, like you said, Danya. like with you with Riverdale, I was so angry. I stopped. But I have been keeping up with the recap so that I know what's going on. So I know that Michael is dead, I guess in some ways makes me happy, but in some ways only further infuriates me, because then now he gets to go out like a martyr, which is not fair. But so my hype and gripe is, gripe is Michael, and my hype is Raphael, who is superior to Michael in all ways, and now I will explain why. So it's always really bothered me how it was clearly set up that Raphael was Endgame, and that was how it was supposed to work out. But then the cast kind of decided, no, but we like Michael better. And so then it kind of started veering into, oh, but Michael is such a great guy. Even though that's not what was shown on screen, and that's not what we were set up to believe. So I made a spreadsheet, so I'll go point by point now.
You're amazing.
Oh my God, so, I love you, Adiana, so much. Holy crap. So I'm just going to rock up with this spreadsheet. Oh, just speak straight to my heart, Adiana. That's amazing. When are you sharing this spreadsheet with me?
So in terms of family values, which is something that Jane always liked to like throw in Raphael's face and be like, oh, but our values are so different because I care about family and you're rich, so you can't. No, that is not true. Okay. Raphael does care about family. So a lot. He cares about his shitty family, even though they are super shitty. He stands by them like the Hufflepuff wanker that he is. He's besties with his sister, even though she like ruins his life all the time. He was loyal to his dad, even though he's like the worst person in the world. And he like acknowledges, he's like, my dad is super bad, but also like, he's my dad. So I have to be like, so I love him. He loves that and looks out for his mom and cares about her, even though she totally abandoned him. Because once again, his whole life, his whole family is shitty. He has had no role models to show him how to be a loving and kind family member. And yet he still is, even with the new people that he brings into his life. He cares about Petra, even though once again, she's trying to ruin his life all the time. He still cares about her. She slept with his best friend and he still cares about her. He takes care of Jane. He takes care of the baby. He makes them his number one priority, like he's supposed to. And once again, he has had no role models to show him how to do this. Michael, on the other hand, has a pretty weird relationship with his brother in the pilot that somehow like never really gets brought up again, because we decided that Michael is not a sleazebag. But like in the pilot, it makes it very clear that no, he has like a sleazy past and he's done terrible things, which he then continues to do over and over again. because he's a dirty cop and is shifty and shady and not who he seems, just like his brother said. But, you know, we get to forget that he's a dirty cop because the narrative decided that they wanted to decide that. But anyway, he's a dirty cop and he's a selfish little bitch who lies all the time and puts Jane's baby in danger all the time. So Michael lied and tried to cover up that Petra was cheating on Raphael because he didn't want to keep his fiance's baby, because it was an inconvenience to him. He was going to give his fiance's baby, the woman that he loves, her baby, to this terrible couple who was going to ruin their lives, ruin the baby's life. He was going to do that. Like, that's the most horrible thing anybody could do. I don't understand how that does not, like, immediately disqualify him from everything he does for the rest of his life, henceforth. Additionally, so that alone is pretty soulless. But then, if you remember, in the pilot, he asked Jane to not have the baby, basically telling her to have an abortion, which is, like, would be its own issue for her individually. I understand that that would not be an issue for everybody, but for the kind of person Jane is, as like a Catholic Latina, that is like something you cannot tell her to do. Like, it would immediately be a disqualifier for you being in her life if you're like, no, actually, Jane, I really don't want you to have your baby because it's inconvenient for me. So that is in an isolated situation. That is something that she would be very mad about. And additionally, what that is different to compare to Raphael, who has always put Jane first and is super selfless in everything, even when he doesn't need to be. He's really selfless. This was his one chance to have a baby because he had cancer, and he didn't even tell her that he had cancer. He did not pull out that card when he saw how sad she was, and she was like, it's just, this is going to be really difficult for me to have a baby. He was like, okay, you know what? You do you, even though he would literally never be able to have a kid again. Like, and this was a girl he just met, not the woman he loves, a girl he just met. And then later on, like when Jane was trying to decide whether to sue Luisa, even though it wouldn't really affect Luisa, it was going to affect him and ruin his whole life. He still did not tell her because he's a good person and he always puts her first and he's always selfless and good. And he does not lie to her, unlike Michael, who lies all the time and is a dirty cop and once again put her baby in danger because he's a dirty cop. And then the real clincher for me was when he so the one time that Raphael did lie was when he did not tell Jane that he told on Michael. But you know what? I give him a pass on that one because Michael was putting their baby in danger by doing all this sleazy stuff on the side. So I think he 100% needed to tell on him. And I also understand that he didn't want to tell Jane that he told on him, because Jane is crazy and likes Michael, even though he is horrible. And then Michael went and he got angry in front of a baby, an infant. Raphael is holding his infant and he's like smashing vases. The idiot. So I hate Michael. What else? Let me see. Is there anything else I'm missing? Later on, this bitch keeps fucking lying. Puts Jane's baby at risk. And then people want to give him a bunch of credit, how he's like, oh yeah, but once the baby was born and I saw you with him, now I care about him because now he's yours. And like, you should have cared about him the minute she cared about him. Like, that's what you should have done. And they're like, oh my gosh, but he didn't deport the grandma. Like, how soulless do you have to be to deport someone's grandma? But anyway, in conclusion, Michael is the safe choice, and Jane doesn't have to challenge herself when she's with him. He is the epitome of white mediocrity, and that really infuriates me because this is essentially a case of white mediocrity versus brown excellence, because Raphael is not, while Justin Baldoni is very white, his character reads as, initially at least, I think they changed it later on, but initially he was read as Hispanic because of his name and his sister, Luisa, who speaks Spanish, and they talk about their mom being in Mexico. There's just, I guess, not enough actual brown actors in Hollywood. Lies. But anyway, but he reads as Hispanic. And it's that whole thing of where you have to be like twice as good to be good enough. And he's like rich, he's handsome, he's pretty perfect, and then they kind of turn his perfections into a flaw, that he can never measure up to the everyman mediocrity that is Michael, the nice guy.
The bit that gets me is that a lot of the time Michael embodies this, and I don't dislike Michael as a character, but he does a lot of the time embody this idea of the nice guy. He is the guy that we should be aspiring to be with. And I don't buy it because, like, so Ariana introduced me to telenovelas, like, outside of Jane the Virgin. I started watching Jane the Virgin and was like, I actually really kind of dig this. It's kind of cool. I really enjoy it. And Ariana told me, like, the names of a couple of different telenovelas and got me to go and watch some outside of it. And then the thing is that once I started watching those, I recognized, like, the story beats that they were starting and the themes and the tropes that they were taking from traditional telenovelas and putting into Jane the Virgin. And the point that we're at right now in Jane the Virgin is very odd to me because, like, I love this idea of subverting tropes. I think it's really interesting, particularly from a storytelling aspect. But when they're trying to be essentially a love letter to the telenovela, they aren't always embracing what makes it a telenovela. And honestly, what Ariana said is that initially Rafael was set up as the end game. And if you watch other telenovelas, you will see that in the theming and the positioning and the way that they set up the characters, that is the, like, you draw the line between them because it was very much set up in exactly the same way. But the point where we're at now, it veered off, I think, towards the end of season one, beginning of season two, into something completely different. And I feel like Jane the Virgin does, like, cliffhangers very, very well. It's really odd. Like, I still enjoy the show a lot. Like, I still really love it. And I feel like the point where we're at post Michael's death, the way that they've been dealing with Jane's grief and how she's been pulling herself back together, like, that whole bit has been incredible. Like, Gina has been amazing with what she's been doing with the material. But a lot of the time, I think it forgets that it's supposed to be a love letter to the telenovela.
And as someone who grew up watching them and loving them and watching them with my whole family, like Jane did, like literally with my grandma after school, other people went and watched Full House. I watched 3 hours of telenovelas after school. Like, it felt kind of like a betrayal because the beginning is very much set up like a telenovela, like with all the tropes there, like Rafael is the hero. Michael is the boyfriend who seems nice, but then you're going to find out he's, like, kind of evil. But then at the end, he might be redeemed or he might go really, really bad. And Petra is the ditzy blonde wife who starts off evil, but probably will be nice by the end. And in a telenovela, from the first episode, you know who you're rooting for. You know, and it's going to be a wild ride to get there, and probably people are going to die, and probably there's going to be a priest who had a love child at some point, but you know where you're getting to. You know, it's like a roller coaster, but you know it's going to end, and you know where it's going to end. Even the credit sequence. The credit sequence literally has always, like, the main couple, like, making out. Like, she's probably in, like, a red dress and they're floating in the river. And that's probably a scene that doesn't happen till the very end. But they put it in the credits. So you know who you're rooting for. And this felt very much like a betrayal of, like, because I think people, like, people who weren't used to the telenovela format, they were like, oh, this is a love triangle. And people who were used to it, like my friends that I know, who watched the telenovelas, they were like, no, obviously, like, it's Rafael. Like, Rafael is the winner. What do you mean love triangle? This isn't a love triangle.
It's really odd that love triangles are not really a thing. It's so obvious in, like, pretty much all of the telenovelas that I've seen. Like, it's very obvious the framing of who the end game is pretty much all the time. That even if there is, like, this third player, that comes in. You never become immediately like worried about it, because yes, there may be like a tiny bit of back and forth, but it's framed so very specifically that you know where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
But it's done in such a really cool way that it doesn't feel like a cheap move. It's so mm-hmm. it's you have to watch you have to watch them to understand like where you come from in that respect. I feel like when you say it out loud, it sounds like completely stupid, but when you're watching it, it makes so much sense.
It makes you feel safe in a way, because yeah. so much crazy stuff is happening, but you but know that in the constant. End it's going to be okay.
Yeah, yeah, there's this one constant. It's almost like your touchstone in the middle of it. Like, it's the lodestone. It's where you come back to. It's that kind of central, safe place, and everything else is completely fuck nuts around it. It's like bonkers, and it's great. I love it so much. But yeah, Jane has like really weird, like a really weird split personality over it. Like, it's caught between these two places, and they're pulling against each other, because they want to in some respects subvert the typical tropes of the telenovela, and like on the other, they want to be this huge sweeping love letter to the genre, and they're fighting. Those two points are fighting each other. So this whole idea of Michael versus Raphael has pretty much epitomized that idea, because I feel like Raphael is the love letter aspect and Michael is the subversion of the genre. And so they've found themselves pulling and fighting against each other. So Jane, in its split personality within its genre, has found itself caught between the two of them. And the fight basically comes down to, is it embracing itself as a telenovela, or is it trying to set itself apart from that? What does it want to be? And I feel like the Michael versus Raphael thing is so much bigger than just the two characters sometimes.
Yeah, it definitely is. Sometimes I feel like the people writing this show and in this show, I mean, obviously, like, Jaime Camille knows it very well. He's a telenovela star. But sometimes I feel like, have you even, like, seen a telenovela before? Or do you just have this idea in your head of what it's supposed to be with crazy things happening? But whatever. The other thing, one more point for Michael that I just remembered. Another thing that bothers me about him as being like the thing that she should aspire to is that I do feel like he's kind of a replacement for the white savior trope that's very common, especially in like American television. Like, it's, you rarely see a woman of color with like a black or brown Asian boyfriend. Like, you, to give her validity, you have to give her a white boyfriend because she's different. She's special. She's not like other brown girls. A white man has approved of her, and therefore she's like, she's pretty and educated. So that kind of bothers me. I feel like he gets elevated a lot. Like, if he was just a, if he wasn't white, I feel like he wouldn't be as special in terms of people seeing him. And, oh, and also I like Raphael because the main point at the beginning where he's like, be practical or be brave. And I think that's the big split between Michael and Raphael. One is practical, one is choosing to be brave. And that's it. That's the end of my rant.
It was a very good rant. I have watched all of Jane the Virgin. Well, first of all, I watched the full two seasons ahead of the season 3 premiere in like the span of 4 days. So it was a lot of Jane, a lot of Jane coming at me. But I always was team Roth because, like you were saying, to every single point, he was not practical and it didn't make a lot of sense, but they worked just so much better than her and Michael. Mm-hmm. And Caitlin was so mad at me because we can never agree on anything.
No, yeah, Raph gets her. He gets her dreams.
Yeah, I also fall. I, I still do fall on Team Raphael, and I, and the thing is though, is that I don't dislike Michael. I like Michael Fine as a character. I just don't, I never felt completely invested in Jane and Michael's relationship, because I didn't feel like for each other they worked. Like that was for me, and I feel like it went both ways with them. Like Michael, I feel like wasn't completely right for Jane, and Jane isn't completely right mm-hmm. for Michael either. And so I felt really odd about it. I still kept watching even after Jane and Michael got married and moved in together and started this life together, and I still kept watching. Mostly because I still like the story that they're trying to tell. I guess I still find it really, really interesting. And I just think I'm in a really odd place with it, because I am both devastated by Michael's death for like what it's, for the impact that it's had on other characters as well, and for what it has, like how Jane's been reacting to it has been really, really important and interesting to like show the after effects of grief and how it like can affect your life and so on. Like that's been really great, but also I'm super disappointed in it from another perspective, because regardless of your feelings on the Michael and Raphael situation, there was still so much story that could have been told mm-hmm. there. And I think you said it, this almost makes him a martyr of sorts to this relationship, that he will always be in Jane's heart this number one. And that's it. There's nothing that's going to take that away now, because it can't, because any other story like them maybe falling out of love and falling apart can never be told now, as they like figure themselves out more within that family dynamic post-marriage, which is, you know, another story that can be told within this sweeping epic romance story. No one ever really tends to show that slowly falling out of love side that happens. And I feel like there was so much more that could have been done with it. The death felt very much like a cop-out from every angle, both in the story that they could have continued to tell with Jane and Michael, but also just the entire story of Jane the Virgin start to finish. And I feel like the direction that we're going in means that potentially we are going to circle back around to Jane and Raphael being the end game, I think. I'm starting to like get that vibe again, because even though Raphael for most of this season was dating another character, and because they completely kept forgetting to say who the character was, and the narrator kept forgetting her, I've also forgotten her name, which I feel really bad about, but he was dating someone else. But the setup and the support that Raphael was giving Jane and helping her with her life and helping her through her grief and all of that, even post him coming out of like jail and stuff like that, was really, really great. And I love the setup that they've got there. But then I feel a little numb to it, because even if they do end up together now, it's at the understanding that he was never her choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love that you said that it felt like Jane and Michael didn't fit, because I felt that from the first episode. Like,
no, it's in the box.
From the first episode, I was like, oh, I see the tropes that are happening here. Michael is going to date Petra, and they're going to be kind of like a fun, sometimes villainous, but also sometimes like good, like the dopey, fun couple.
I was super into the idea of Michael and Petra getting together. Like, I got that vibe as well. So much. And I was like, oh, it's gonna end up like they're gonna realize, like they're gonna find it and realize like what they wanted in these two. Like, it's gonna be like the couples that are together at the start are gonna split and then basically mm-hmm. do a switch. And I thought, oh, that's the kind of story beats are leading towards that. Like, they're setting us up emotionally that that is the way that they're going. And it's, yes, okay, it's like this vaguely cliche romance trope. But
I think they would have been such a great couple. So fun.
Yeah.
And you could have kept both of them on the show that way.
Yeah. It just, even though it could have been tropey and cliche and kind of a little expected to a certain degree, because that's kind of what you expect, like, that's the telenovela thing. It's the expected, but it's in the execution of the writing and how it's done that sets it apart from its trope. And it had so much potential, and it just... I don't completely dislike the point that we're at in Jane right now. I'm still really enjoying it. I'm really liking, like, the struggle that Jane is having with Mateo's behavior, and the struggle that she's having with trying to balance the fallout of her grief with still trying to be this rock for Mateo. And yeah, it's like they're telling a really interesting story still, but just there are certain things about it that I'm like, I think about what could have been, and I think that's what disappoints me. But I'm not completely disliking the show. So it's this, I'm in this really weird, like, middle ground of, like, going between those two points. But I'm still watching.
So. Yeah, I may start watching again. I keep trying to hype myself up to do it.
Like I said, I haven't completely disliked this season. I think it had some interesting things to say. So I feel like if you are in the emotional place to be able to pick it back up, it's got some interesting stuff going on, and I would be interested to hear what you would have to say about what's playing out. Also, Zen Raphael was hot as hell.
Oof.
Holy crap. Oh my God.
I know. The disappearance of Zen Raphael is getting, like, because the beard is gone now. I'm like, wait.
Yeah, I really want the beard to come back. But wow, Zen Raphael was
when they,
a
like,
lot to
opened
handle.
Back up after Michael's death with Zen Raphael and, like, his white linen shirts. And I was like, what is happening? I'm so into this.
Yeah, it was kind of like, why am I so, like, obscenely attracted to this? Because I like, there are certain cues here. There are certain visual cues here. And, like, as a whole, I should not be attracted to this in any way, shape, or form.
It's
but
like the Beast.
Wow.
It's like the Beast.
Yeah. And oh, Disney's Robin Hood. It's like, I understand that I should not be attracted to this. And yet.
And yet a cartoon fox is really attractive.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
they should remake that one.
Oh, ooh, I don't know. live action Robin Hood. Oh my goodness. Well, speaking of really hairy men, I would like to use this opportunity to segue into a different hype that I can't seem to find the words to talk about, but also can't stop talking about in just short, very declarative sentences. And it's about Logan and how much I loved Logan. I went through all of, like, I'm like, you know what? Let me see how many X-Men movies I've actually seen before I go see Logan, because I feel like I missed, like, 5 or 6 somewhere along the lines. And how far, let me see how many involved Wolverine and how much I'm actually missing before going into Logan. Turns out I've seen all of the X-Men movies except the most recent one, because when it came out, everyone said it was so bad and not worth seeing. So I didn't see, I think it was Apocalypse? Whichever one still had Michael Fassbender in it, I didn't see that one. So I was like, oh, okay, I'm actually in pretty good shape to go see Logan. It looks good. It doesn't look like it's too superhero-y. I don't really watch any of the Marvel movies, but apparently X-Men is the exception, but they don't really exist in that Disney Marvel cinematic universe. So I go to see Logan, sit down, loving it, cried twice. Left the movie theater, didn't know what to do with myself, so I messaged Karen, and I was like, listen, I just saw Logan, and I need to talk about it. It was the reason I messaged Karen was because, and this is like a bigger conversation that we've been having outside of this podcast, just in with a bunch of hyperbole writers, is that like this is, if every single superhero movie had one movie like Logan, I would spend all the money in the world to watch every single one of them. It was so good and like just a raw story of like an aging, sick guy at the end of his life and then taking care of his mentor and like father figure who has Alzheimer's, and it hurt so bad. It was so good. Like, there's like, you know, this whole plot line with the mutants and mutant children and just how disconnected Logan feels from that world and how Wolverine really hasn't done anything for him. So he's just trying to keep Charles alive and, you know, just he's driving as like a limo Uber driver and just to get money. And it's so great. It's such like a, they just deconstruct this guy down to like nothing at the end of the movie. You're just like, what is happening to this? Like, you know, he just gives up basically, but he finds like that little moment of happiness. And it just blew me away. Have you guys seen Logan at all?
Yes. Okay. I saw it.
I have not. I really, really wanted to. And then Mitch was like, no, it's so horrible. There's kids killing each other. And I was like, oh, is this going to scare me? Because I don't like horror movies.
Yeah.
But no, then I realized that, no, Mitch doesn't like Hunger Games either.
It's not scary. It is, I mean, it's bloody because, you know, Wolverine, the way he fights is not, you know, he like shoves those, like, you know, claws into people's skulls. But I mean, it's gross. And I was kind of happy that it was that gross, like, because they really fought to make it an R movie. And, mm-hmm. you know, Hugh Jackman took a pay cut because he's like, no, it has to be R. Like, I don't care about the money and making it PG-13. This is the last time I'm playing Wolverine and I'm stepping away from X-Men after this, and it's going to be the way it should be intended to be made. And in regards to the children, I mean, they're mutants and they're fighting for their lives. So they show like the side of their experimentation and how they're actually creating these kids. Like there's like maybe 10 or 12 and they're breeding them in a lab. And so they're having them fight each other, but they're not killing each other. They're fighting to survive once they get out. These nurses save them. And so they're trying to make it to this, place called Eden, which is like, you know, they have to get out of America and get to Canada because they'll be safe there. There are laws against mutants in America. And so they have
to. So timely.
It's so timely.
Yeah, right?
So they have to, like, get across the border to Canada. And they're just trying to survive. And they fight. They don't fight each other. They fight, like, you know, the people who are trying to kill them. So I thought the kids were, they're not in the movie that much. But they were, well, besides 23 and Laura is her name. She is in the movie the whole time and she's incredible. Oh my God. Watching this girl just kick ass, and she doesn't really speak for most of the movie. And she is so talented. Oh my God. Her story killed me. But yeah, don't listen to Mitch. The kids fight, but they're not like killing each other.
No, I'm pretty sure I would like it. I just have to find an afternoon now to go see it. But yeah, I was like, oh, really, Mitch? Because I heard it's good.
But yeah,
he didn't like it.
It's really, I absolutely loved it. And the reason I text Karen when I got out of the theater was because the only thing that I could think of was, oh my God, I want to see a movie called Stark so badly, because I just think that I've only seen Iron Man in the Avengers. But I just think that he has such a dark, dark story that it would be so good. And Natalie, of course, wants a Steve movie and a Bucky movie, I'm sure. But I, my mind instantly went to a Tony Stark film just because.
Yeah. And if this was another life where, we had someone playing Black Widow that I wasn't suddenly not enamored of, I would want a Black Widow movie in this sort of style because it fits her. I mean, it's in the same respect of what happened to Bucky in her conditioning and her training mm-hmm. with the Red Room would play really well into like this sort of thematic feel because it's not a nice story to tell. So it deserves that kind of respect for its origins because it's not an easy story. It's not something that can be kind of condensed down into something palatable for a general audience. It deserves that respect to tell it the way that it is. And so I feel like that would be one that I would have wanted to see at one point or another. If we were talking like comic book characters that I would have wanted to see, I feel like there's a lot of potential. I mean, right, here's the thing with Hawkeye is that his story is really interesting, but I feel like it would work better in like a slice of life, serialized television version more than I feel it needs the Logan treatment. Mm-hmm. Because in certain respects, yes, he did become an assassin of sorts for S.H.I.E.L.D., but at the same time, there's a lot in his backstory that is more than would be told in this kind of... I feel like with Hawkeye and with Clint Barton as a character, he the way that he grew up and the abuse storyline from his home life where he runs away to the circus and gets taken in there and basically falls into another mentor-mentee relationship that is that basically molds him into someone that can be used for different means after like discovering his talents, and he ends up basically aiding criminals without realizing that's what he's doing because he's just being trained and molded in that respect. Like, it's a really interesting, fascinating backstory that I feel like should be told because it's like where he comes from, like, completely explains how he is so messed up when it comes to any kind of emotional attachments and relationships. Like, the Hawkeye that I feel deserved to be on screen is not the one that we've got, is not the one with 2.4 kids and a white picket fence and a beautiful wife. Like, that I'm sorry, new podcast, who dis? Like, that is not the Hawkeye that I was ever interested in. That is an alternate universe Hawkeye that they pulled from that nobody likes. It was from a universe called Ultimates and everyone thinks it's stupid. So, and then no, you laugh, but it's true. It's not even just me as like a Hawkeye fan saying that. There is very little in the Ultimates universe that people actually genuinely like. So I don't understand this ridiculous notion of trying to keep taking stuff from it to put on the screen. It's stupid. But yeah, there's a lot in Hawkeye's whole story that is really very interesting, but I don't know that I would want to see the Logan treatment for him. Yes, I want to see Hawkeye everything, but there's like, I feel as though like some weird slice of life dark action comedy would work better, and like probably a Netflix format I think would work better for Hawkeye, particularly if they took story beats from Matt Fraction's run, because that gels more with how Hawkeye is, I feel. Not that it couldn't be a little violent, because, you know, Hawkeye gets into like some really stupid scrapes sometimes and he gets hurt and he's just a perpetual fuck up, but I don't know. Yeah, he's not the one that I would have immediately gone, this hero, this superhero, this character needs the Logan treatment. I don't know that it's a format that would work specifically for him. I feel Black Widow, for me, would be the one that it would work better for. And yeah, he could show up in that because their backstories are quite linked together quite closely. But I don't know. Yeah, no. That probably seems odd for everyone that I would be like, actually, no, I don't think a Hawkeye film would be the right choice here. And everyone will just be like, testing my temperature, like, are you feeling okay, Danielle? Like,
and you want the Stark one, right, Brittany?
I would. I would like a Stark one from the grand total of 4 hours that I've seen Robert Downey Jr. play Iron Man in a movie. Yes, I would. I have seen, I think, Iron Man 3, the part, I've seen bits and pieces of it.
Oh,
like,
why?
Where he's in, like, because it's on FX sometimes before, like, American mm-hmm. Horror Story starts. So I usually catch the end of it all the time.
One and two are really delightful. I think you should watch them.
Yeah, I definitely need to watch one at least. At least watch the first one. I've seen the beginning of it like 100 times, like where he goes out to test the weapons and stuff. I've seen that so many times, but really nothing beyond that. Like, I don't even get to the part where he has the suit, so it's really, really not a good enough baseline to really champion a Stark movie. But I think in another regard, Logan does a lot for the character of Wolverine, because Wolverine is like he's just a horrible, horrible character. Like, watching the movie, Wolverine is not that great. And, you know, aside from his like cameos in Days of Future Past and a couple of other movies, he's usually just like sitting at the bar, like being a grump. And he's not really that involved in anything that's going on. So his character is just not likable, which was kind of interesting when I was like, you know what, I'm going to go see Logan. I've heard really good things about it, because I didn't really like Wolverine that much. I actually like Days of Future Past a lot more. And so I'm like, all right, well, let's just put this one on and see what happens. And it is so great, because he isn't a likable character, and he knows that he's had a horrible life, and he's at the end of his time even trying or wanting to be that man. And like, how do you separate yourself from people coming up to you and being like, it's the Wolverine? And, you know, he doesn't want that anymore, and he's refusing to accept that he's aging. And there's a whole bit where he has to like get reading glasses, and like, there's a lot of humor in Logan as well, which I think is great. But it's also like heart-wrenching watching him and Charles interact, and just hearing, you know, how much Charles cares about him still, even though, you know, Wolverine could like give two shits about what's happening in the world and his life. So yeah, I really recommend it. Even if you haven't seen any of the X-Men movies, I think it's a great standalone film. It really does a good job of setting up what you need to know, and it doesn't really pull too much on anything that you would have had to have seen from the other X-Men movies.
No, so, mostly I feel like if you know who Charles Xavier is, and if you know who Wolverine is, and just like even the bare bones basics of his origin, like how he got his powers, I feel like that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you know those two things. And even then, you get a lot of context for Logan's background through the child experiments in this film.
Yeah, they really set it up well. So like, even if you haven't seen any of the movies in a long time, like if you gave up on the X-Men universe,
yeah, they're still
a long
just
time ago,
vaguely,
you'll be fine.
Yeah, they're still vaguely
enough.
Do
they tell you?
Tell you
what happened to like Storm and like that, those
no,
people.
It's not about,
they don't mention
it,
them at all.
Yeah, no, it's not about anything. Like, it's so isolated, and I think that's why it's so good, is because they're not leaning on anything that has happened. I mean, they talk about they talk about like one or two events, but only in passing. Like it's not a, there's nothing where you would, like if you're going to see Logan, you're not going to find out what's going on with everyone else. You're okay. only going for Wolverine and Charles's relationship and just watching one character, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. It's so great, like, watching. There's the part where, it's not really spoilery, but they just, like, are interacting with a normal family. And it's so, it's just so good. It's so grounded and taken, like, just seeing them trying to find, like, some little bits of just enjoying a normal life and trying to do a few normal things without their anything of their powers or stuff like that coming into play. It's just so, so good. And I think the action sequences are choreographed so well. I am always really into a good fight scene and just watching choreography like that. And the way that, I mean, when you have a character like Wolverine, he's a very gritty fighter because he has to hit with his hands and he has to get up close and, you know, he can get shot, but he gets the bullet, like, you know, he's impervious to bullets. And so it's just so, so good. It's so good. I highly recommend it. And I hope there are more films like it, even if they're not like in a superhero context, like I'd watch some like Kirk, the movie, you know, like, you know, it'd be great.
Oh, my God. Yes. Why would you say that?
Yeah, I know. I thought it's, or like Bones. Can you imagine? That would be a comedy, though. That would be a comedy. There's no way they could get that serious with Bones.
Yeah, no, it's true. But like, I want a film about Bones.
Yeah. So it's just something that has really stuck in my mind, just how beautiful it was and what a great story. And I want movies to do that even within franchises. Like, it doesn't have to be the blockbuster hit of the summer. It could just be like, you can get away with making something like this. And I love good character studies.
Yeah. I like the idea of, character studies basically is what they are. Mm-hmm. And just this idea that we don't need to keep building up to this huge event, that it's okay if they're operating on their own. It's okay if they have a life outside of this huge spanning universe that you've set up. I love the introspective character pieces a lot more, where they just get to be outside of like everything else going on. And yes, to an extent, like the Captain America movies and the Iron Man movies and the Thor movies and that, they do sort of exist as like introspective character pieces, but not like this. This really just decided to take a step away from the expectations that we have from a superhero movie, mm-hmm. and do something completely different. And I thought it was very, very successful in what it did. And it put me in mind a little bit of what Winter Soldier did a lot for Steve Rogers, but on like a completely different level again. Like, I feel like Steve Rogers could very, very, very easily have a film with like a similar introspective kind of look. So, yeah, I don't know. It just, I really, really loved it a lot.
Yep, go see it. See it 100 times. Let me know what you think. Talk to me on Twitter about it. Most of my sentences will just be like, I know, it's so good, because I can't form coherent sentences still about what I witnessed. But something that I don't like and don't find humorous, and it's nothing against the creator or her talents, I just hate it. Let's talk about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, because Danya wants to hype about it. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, so I was having I've had a really tough time the first couple of months of this year, and I went through a period where I just didn't want to watch anything that I had a lot of investment in. I wanted to watch something with, like, I had no emotional attachment to. I wanted to watch something that I didn't care whether it was great or not. I had, like,
zero expectations for it at all. I just wanted to switch off for a little bit. So I was flicking through Netflix and came across Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and Brooke had always said that she felt like this is a show that I would really enjoy. And I don't know, for a lot of time I had a lot of preconceived notions about it based on its name, which is stupid. It's really stupid of me, and I fully fully recognize that in myself, that I was like judging it based on just its name. But she said give it a shot, and I was like, so when I came across it on Netflix, I was like, well, I don't really have an investment one way or the other if I like this or not, so I want to watch something and I'm having a terrible time, so I might as well give it a go. And I did, and it surprised me in a lot of ways. I don't think it's a perfect series in any respect. It has a lot of problems. But with those problems, that a lot of the time come from huge character flaws, those characters aren't forgiven for them a lot of the time. Like, the show fully recognizes that these characters can be assholes. Like, it does recognize that the behavior that they engage in is very problematic and borderline illegal, and, they don't excuse it. But there were certain things about this show that at the time in which I was watching it, it was almost like this perfect storm of, I can't believe that I missed this. Because the one thing that I think that Crazy Ex-Girlfriend does and does particularly well is the way that it handles and puts a spotlight on mental health issues and how we deal with those and how we act and react and operate if you have anxiety or if you have almost like an obsessive kind of fixation on a certain aspect of your life that you feel like as long as you've got a handle on that, you've got a handle on everything else. So that was really, really good. Also, the way that it approached sexuality. There are two characters, Daryl and a character called White Josh, who I absolutely loved. Like, I feel a lot of the time, though, that White Josh is the most well-adjusted character in the entire show, and he's just, like, sitting there in the middle of, like, all of these characters being like, hey, maybe we shouldn't do that thing because, you know, let's just not do it because that's not, like, the guys, okay, yeah, you're doing the thing anyway, fine, yeah, no, I'm just gonna sit here and have my drink. But, like, in terms of, like, the healthiest relationship, I think they've probably got the healthiest relationship out of everyone on the show, and they have a lot of open discussion, but it was also one that I wasn't expecting to, like, shake out, and I'm very invested in them, and there are, like, certain things about the show that I'm kind of, like, uncomfortable with. But on the whole, it took me by surprise. So I think that was something that I really enjoyed about it. And I burned through the two seasons that were on Netflix in less than a week. I think it took me, like, 3 days to watch the whole thing.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, Brooke was on the receiving end of my I was texting her on WhatsApp as I was watching and reacting. So she was on the receiving end of that. And literally she went away for a couple of hours and she came back and I'd like burned through like so many episodes. And she was like, what the hell? What happened? And I was like, well, apparently I'm not in a great place mentally and I am taking it out on watching this show. So you're welcome, I guess. But yeah, the songs are really great as well. There are a couple that I was like, whoa, okay, I'm not too sure about where this is going. But there were a few where I was just in hysterics. I just thought they were really funny. But I feel like, for me, it was just a show that came along at the right time for me. And it really turned me around, like, the week after. And now I'm back to, like, watching shows like I was as normal, because I was like, hey, if a show like this can just surprise me, then why am I like working myself up so much over like everything else I'm watching? I should just, it is what it is, and I should just go and watch and take everything as it as it comes. And yeah, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend did that for me, so thanks.
I was on mute.
Oh. I was like,
and then there was silence.
I was like, I also have nothing to really contribute because I just don't find Crazy Ex-Girlfriend amusing. I don't know what it is. I just, it's like, it's too cringeworthy for me. And I have the same problem with Girls. And
Girls.
Well, Girls has its own issues. But yeah, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, I tried and tried and tried and tried and tried to watch it because everyone I know loves it, and I can't do Broad City. I didn't like that either. I'm just like, maybe something's wrong with me. And I think that I like all of the creators of the two shows. Lena Dunham is problematic, but the other two, I really like every person that's involved with it, but for some reason, mm-hmm. when I'm watching the show, I just can't do it. It's too, like you were saying, Danya, like, you know, you could just watch something, and if with those shows, I just can't just watch it. Like, for some reason, I'm like so uncomfortable watching them, and it's so yeah. weird. I don't know what it is.
It's like watching secondhand embarrassment.
Yes,
I think. What's her name? Rachel Bloom. Who's Rachel Bloom's character? What's her name?
It's Rachel. Tanya?
Yeah. The main character. Oh, the main character.
Rebecca.
Rebecca. Rebecca gives me a lot of secondhand embarrassment. I actually really enjoy Rebecca's friends. I think that they're really fun.
Yes. Heather is great. And I love her to bits. And Valencia.
I love Valencia.
Valencia, I'm like super, super into. In fact, at one point I was saying to Brooke that I felt like they should go, because I feel like the both of their fixations on Josh as like mm-hmm. this central piece that could just fix their entire lives as long as they could make that work really didn't help either character. And when they started getting this friendship in season two, when, like, it was actually a genuine friendship, and they sort of came back around to this place of, like, really understanding each other and trying to move on, I really loved that. And also, I ship them, like, a lot. I think they both have...
But see, they have great chemistry, but now I'm worried because I feel like... I'm worried that then if they got together, then would it ruin them? I love them so much. And I don't like Rebecca when she's with anybody. Like,
that's true. She has a lot of problems that I'm hoping that maybe she'll get a chance to work through in the next season now that without any spoilers, Josh has been removed as something that is attainable for anyone.
I heard about that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting choice.
It was a very interesting narrative choice that
Father Bra
not...
is also my favorite character.
Yes,
I love him.
He's so great. I just love that he gets high all the time. It's so funny.
What's so funny is his character is like a very specific type of like Jesuit raised boy, like that's definitely like a type of priest that exists.
Yeah. But yeah, so they did something without like going into spoilers, they did something very specific with Josh's arc that means that he's off the table as a romantic prospect, I guess, if that's the right word, but he's no longer an option for anyone. So it was very interesting, that choice that they made, and I would like to see how they deal with that in the next season, because the whole thing up until now has always had like this huge question looming of like what happens like when Becca and Josh get together and they have their happily ever after, but now that happily ever after isn't something that can happen. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see where they take the show in season 3.
Well, I'm glad that you have this show now and it's in your life and it's making you happy, because I think we all need that. I've been contemplating, like, there's just so much on TV and so much coming. April, I have like 9 shows that are premiering that I want to actively watch every week. Some shows are also still on that I watch every week. Like, I'm so overwhelmed with what is coming in April that I'm like, maybe I should just rewatch all of Brothers and Sisters, because, you know, I have time for 6 seasons and an hour long drama. It's fine. I could do it. And like, I keep like walking myself into this corner and then being like, no, why don't you watch like what episode of Superstore aired this week? Because you're already behind on what's coming. And I'm getting very antsy about having to watch everything all the time on time, and it's like starting to get overwhelming, because once April starts, it doesn't end, and everything is on Sunday. Everything. Veep, The Leftovers, American Gods, Once Upon a Time, everything is on Sundays. I like don't know what to do.
It's supposed to be the day of rest.
It is not. It is not. From 8 o'clock until 11 o'clock, there's like it's only 4 hours, but there's like 10 hours of content on that I need to watch.
Oh my god.
I'm like, what can I possibly do to make this, like, not, I don't know. But my guilty pleasure, Grace and Frankie, is coming back next week, so that's exciting. I'm very, very much looking forward to that. That usually comes out in May, and it's coming out in March this year, which is huge. Woo-hoo. So that is my happy place, watching Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. I love them so much. It's so funny. Ugh, I cannot wait. But that's going to be my happy place show, where I could just turn everything off, watch that for like a day, and then get back, prepare for April. Oh my gosh, I'm getting anxious just thinking about it. So let's move into something also anxiety inducing, which is 2 truths and a lie. Because
yay,
I said I was going to come up with them and I didn't. So that's great.
Come up with them right now.
I am. I'm going to think. Do we have a theme? Can I get a theme? Because then cats. That'll help. Cats. Okay. I could do cats. I can make cats work. I'll make cats work.
Okay.
All right. So, 2 truths and a lie. I have seen the musical Cats in its original run. I have a cat who is turning 19 this year. And I have, this one could go either way. I don't know if I want to, Okay, I once had 3 cats that were named Tom, Dick, and Harry.
You have not seen Cats in its original run. You probably have, but I'm like, no, you can't be that old.
I'm trying to remember when Cats' original run was.
That was like 20 years ago, wasn't it?
It was on Broadway for a long time.
Yeah. Do you know, I think I might be inclined to say that as well. Because I feel like it happened a long time ago.
Well, you are both correct, because I've never seen Cats. Even in
There we go.
I was going to say, like, this run, but I was like, no, they're pretty up to date on my life, and this only started a year ago, so they would know if I've seen it in the last year.
Yeah.
But I did have cats named Tom, Dick, and Harry. The cat who is turning 19 this year, she had kittens, and we already had so many cats because she was, like, a breeder. She was, like, she wasn't fixed, and she, like, for some reason, just always, she had cats all the time. And so we brought them to give them up for adoption. And what you do is you bring them, and then they would stay there for a few days. And then if no one adopted them, we'd take them back. So eventually we ended up just keeping these 3 cats because, no one adopted them and we didn't want to put them down. So we kept them. And the woman was like, oh, well, what are their names? We'll put it on the cards. And we're like, oh, we didn't name them. And so she named them Tom, Dick, and Harry. So,
oh
yeah. So we, yeah, we had a good time with those guys, and then we eventually gave them away. But yeah, they were funny, but yelling their names around the house was like a Three Stooges movie. It was like, God, there's so many cats. For a while, I was like, we have to find somewhere to get rid of these cats. They're great cats, but I'm not a huge cat fan. I'm actually allergic to them, so wasn't a good time. Yeah, so that's two truths and a lie about cats for this episode. We made it happen, guys. And okay, so now we're going to move into a question from a listener, and we are going to try to give some advice. Natalie sent this to me ahead of time and says, do you think you can speak to this? And I'm like, I don't know, but I can try. So we have a question from Laura Morrow, who is a longtime listener on a couple of podcasts. And she says, I'm in a long-distance relationship, and the only real part of the relationship is sexting. How do I tell the boy that does not a relationship make, and it legit means nothing to me, without hurting him? We do nothing else but that. Help. I would ghost him.
Hopefully he listens to this podcast.
Yeah.
And you got the hint.
I would ghost him. If sexting is all it is, and just delete the number.
I will give you the Slytherin answer and say, if you enjoy sexting with him, then keep sexting. And if you do not, then tell him, I do not enjoy this anymore. And as Brittany said, then ghost.
That's it. Yes. Yeah.
So,
you're never going to have to see him again.
Oh, God. As someone who has been involved in a long distance relationship, the one thing that I will tell you is so important if this is something that you want to continue pursuing, like if you are in this relationship because you really like this boy and it's something that you want to make work, communication and honesty is key. Because the second that you stop trying to communicate and you try and like patch it up with other stuff, it's not gonna work, because you don't have that in-person relationship to be able to judge how someone is thinking or feeling. All you have is whatever communication you have between you, and if sexting is not what you want from it, then you need to tell him that. And it may hurt. I'm not saying that it will or it won't. There's no way of knowing. But if you are not honest with him, then it's going to end up getting complicated and messy and worse the longer you let it go on. So just be honest. Like, it sucks and it's not as easy as saying it. But yeah, definitely just talk to him, because it sounds like it's not something that's doing it for you currently, but it is maybe for him if that's the only thing that he wants to do. But then again, if you haven't told him that it's not a great relationship for you anymore just doing that, he may be feeling the same way and is also in the same boat where he's like, this is all that we do, and this is the only way that we can keep the relationship going, maybe. So just be honest. That's my advice, I think.
Tanya, much better than me. I'm like, you should just leave. Oh, yeah, but if any part of it is working for you, then I agree with Danya. Speak to the parts that aren't working and try to make them work, because there's clearly some investment coming from both ends, and you should make the most of it if it's something you're both willing to work towards. But then also ghost him if you don't.
Yeah. If you don't care, just ghost.
Yeah. All right. So that wraps up our discussion for this week on Not About the Weather. And we would love to hear from you. So please continue to get in touch. Give us questions to answer. Maybe we'll provide better advice than just ghosting someone. That's why we have Danya to balance this out, because we all think differently. So we like to come together and share our thoughts with you, and hopefully you're enjoying the conversations that are happening. But before we go, we have one final new little traditional Not About the Weather thing that we've been trying to do, which is to end on a haiku written by Ariana. Please take it away.
Too often has Jane chosen mediocrity over excellence.
Preach. That was great. All right, so that's all we have for you today. Thanks for listening, and we will be back soon in a new combination of hosts to talk about anything and everything that's bugging us and making us excited. So, adios.
Bye.
Woohoo, nailed it. Let's do this bad boy that doesn't have a number. No number, no number, no number. Okay. Welcome back to Not About the Weather episode. Oh, fuck. See, I already messed it up. See, she can't have, she cannot have episode here because I read. She can't do that.
Why can't we just put it up and just, well, I guess.
Because I don't know if she's going to, she might listen to them and want to do last night's first and then do tonight, like this one second, or put this one up first and put that one second. I don't know.
All right.
All right. I deleted the episode. I hope she does bloopers because that's a great one.
That is a great one.
All right. Let's do it. Actually, you know what? I'm going to get rid of anything that I could possibly say that is going to mess me up. Oh, all right. Is it Not About the Weather podcast? I don't know. Because I feel weird saying that.
Here, I'll take out this part that says don't say the number.
Oh, okay. There we go. Thank you. We have to make this idiot proof. Oh, my God. All right. Whew.